Welcome back to the Deep Dive, where we unpack complex topics to give you the clear, actionable insights you need. Today, we're diving into a company that has, well, utterly dominated headlines and market charts recently, Novo Nordisk. You might know them for their revolutionary weight loss and diabetes drugs, but what does it really mean to understand this pharmaceutical giant, especially, you know, from an investment perspective?
Yeah.
Consider this. The global obesity and diabetes crisis is just staggering. In 2021, 537 million adults were living with diabetes, a number projected to explode to 783 million by 2045. That's huge. And the obesity market, currently valued at about, what, $15.9 billion in 2024?
That's right.
It's projected to reach over $60 billion by 2030. And some forecasts push it to an astounding $150 billion by 2035.
It's almost hard to comprehend that level of growth. It really is.
It really is. So we've gathered an extensive stack of financial reports, market analyses, industry research, basically everything we could find to go beyond the headlines. We want to give you a shortcut to truly being well-informed.
And what's truly fascinating here, I think, is how a single company can have such a profound and simultaneous impact. We're talking global health on one hand and the financial markets on the other. Their products are quite literally reshaping how we think about and treat chronic diseases worldwide. So our mission today is to really extract the most important nuggets of knowledge from all this material, you know, the business, the market dynamics, the risks, and of course, the immense opportunities, so you can understand what really drives this powerhouse.
Exactly. So what does this all mean for you, whether you're just intensely curious or maybe prepping for a big meeting? We're going to break down their century-long history, dissect their blockbuster products, analyze their position in these hyper-growth markets, and definitely peek into their future. Get ready, because it's time to unpack this. Okay, let's start by laying the groundwork. This isn't some overnight sensation, right? Novo Nordisk didn't just appear out of nowhere with these drugs.
No, absolutely not. There's a deep, compelling history here that really underpins everything they do today. At its core, Novo Nordisk is a global healthcare company headquartered in Bagsvær, Denmark. Now, its formal origins trace back to a merger in 1989, but its legacy, that legacy of innovation in treating serious chronic diseases, actually spans an entire century.
A whole century?
Yeah, and this isn't just some corporate trivia point. It speaks to a deep institutional knowledge base built over generations. It's almost like a family secret recipe for innovation passed down.
A century of innovation.
Yep.
Oh, that's profound. Does that long history translate into a unique competitive advantage now? Or are they still facing the same pressures as, say, younger biotechs trying to break in?
That's a crucial question, and I'd say yes, it absolutely does translate. Their business model is quite precise, highly focused almost, surgically so. It centers entirely on the research, development, manufacturing, and commercialization of novel protein-based therapeutics.
Protein-based therapeutics, so we're talking complex biologics.
Exactly. Think of them as highly sophisticated, targeted keys designed to unlock or block specific biological pathways in your body. Much more targeted than older, sort of blunt instruments. This century-long focus has allowed them to build an incredibly robust intellectual property, or IP, portfolio around these complex molecules. And crucially, they also manufacture these complex drugs in-house on a very large scale.
Ah, the manufacturing piece. That seems important.
It's fundamental. These pillars, deep IP and massive in-house manufacturing capabilities, aren't just advantages. They are incredibly difficult barriers for anyone else to replicate.
So innovators, builders, and protectors of what they create. Okay. Moving on, their financial reports split things into two main segments. Can you walk us through those and give us a sense of which one is really, you know, driving the engine?
Certainly. Novo Nordisk has two primary reporting segments, diabetes and obesity care, and rare disease. And these aren't just arbitrary divisions. They reflect where the company invests its resources and, importantly, where its revenue is overwhelmingly generated.
And I think it's pretty clear which one is the powerhouse, right? The one driving all those headlines.
Oh, undoubtedly. The diabetes and obesity care segment is the undisputed engine of their growth and profitability. It's staggering. In 2023 alone, it generated DKK 215.1 billion in sales.
Wow.
Which is an astonishing, approximately 93% of their total revenue.
93%.
Okay. Yeah. And this segment's performance is overwhelmingly driven by a specific class of drugs. Glucagon-like peptide 1 receptor agonists. You'll hear them called GLP-1s.
GLP-1s, right. Those are the ones everyone's talking about.
Exactly. These drugs have, well, quite literally revolutionized the treatment paradigms for both type 2 diabetes and obesity.
So the GLP-1s are really where the magic is happening. I remember reading something about a strategic shift maybe even internal cannibalization within their business because of this. What does that mean? And why is it supposedly a good thing?
It's a fascinating and, frankly, bold strategic move. The explosive success of their high-growth GLP-1 franchise is increasingly supplanting their legacy insulin business, which is still significant, but now much slower growing.
So they're basically replacing their own older drugs with newer ones.
Precisely. This internal cannibalization might sound counterintuitive, maybe even negative, like one part eating another, but it's far from a sign of weakness. If we connect this to the bigger picture, it shows a company that is not afraid to disrupt its own successful lines when a more effective therapy emerges.
Okay, that makes sense. Better to disrupt yourself than let someone else do it.
Exactly. It's proactive. It demonstrates their commitment to leading with innovation, even if it means evolving past their own older products. And it reflects a broader market shift, too. Towards therapies that offer superior glycemic control, yes, but also significant weight loss, and critically proven cardiovascular and renal benefits. This evolution has effectively transformed their core value proposition. They've gone from just treating diabetes symptoms to managing a whole spectrum of cardiometabolic health conditions, addressing the underlying issues more comprehensively.
That's a really smart, if maybe tough, strategic choice, competing with yourself for better patient outcomes. What about the other segment, the smaller one, rare disease?
Right. The rare disease segment is much smaller, contributing DKK 17.2 billion in sales in 2023. It focuses on therapies for conditions like hemophilia and rare endocrine disorders, including growth disorders. And while it's a strategic priority for diversification, it has recently faced some headwinds.
Headwinds? Like what?
We've seen sales declines, actually, attributed to temporary manufacturing output reductions. It just highlights this segment's sensitivity to supply chain disruptions. It's a good reminder that even for a company as huge as Novo Nordisk, operational challenges in one area can directly impact revenue, even if it's not the main growth engine.
Okay, so we've talked GLP-1s, but for most people, the name Novo Nordisk immediately brings up specific drug names, like Ozempic, Wegovy. Given this dominance of semaglutide, their key molecule, do you think there's a one-trick pony risk here, or is there more to it?
That's a perceptive question. And yeah, it's something investors actively discuss. Novo Nordisk's value is undeniably highly concentrated in its semaglutide-based products, no question. However, I wouldn't call it a one-trick pony. It's more like a masterfully executed one-molecule strategy.
Okay, unpack that. One-molecule strategy.
They've taken a single molecule, semaglutide, and developed it into three distinct blockbuster brands, each targeting a slightly different part of the market or offering a unique delivery method. It maximizes its reach and utility.
And those three brands are?
First, you have Ozempic. That's their once-weekly injectable formulation, primarily approved for type 2 diabetes. Its strong efficacy in lowering blood glucose and promoting significant weight loss made it a global blockbuster, really set the stage.
Right.
Then there's Wegovy. This is a higher dose, once weekly injectable, specifically approved for chronic weight management. The launch of Wegovy was truly a game changer. It unlocked this vast, historically underserved obesity market, generated just unprecedented demand that has consistently, for years now, outstripped their manufacturing capacity.
That demand issue seems key. And the third one?
The third is Rybelsus. This one's quite innovative because it's the first and only oral formulation of a GLP-1 receptor agonist.
The pill version.
Exactly. A pill. Offers a convenient alternative to injections for patients with type 2 diabetes. It significantly expands the addressable market by appealing to those who, well, prefer a pill.
Okay, that makes sense. So one molecule, but deployed very strategically across different needs and preferences.
Precisely. While it's one molecule, it's a versatile molecule, strategically deployed.
It definitely sounds like semaglutide is the golden goose here. But just to be complete, they do have other products, right, beyond this golden molecule.
They do, yes. To provide a complete picture, they maintain a comprehensive portfolio of insulins. Things like Trizibi, Novolodge, Levemir. These are their traditional bread and butter before the whole GLP-1 explosion. And within that rare disease segment we mentioned, they have products for conditions like hemophilia, Nova 7 is a key one, and growth hormone deficiencies with Norditropin. But yeah, make no mistake. The semaglutide dominance is profound. It underpins almost all the recent growth and, frankly, the market excitement around the company.
Got it. Now, where is all this money actually coming from, geographically speaking? I've heard the U.S. is a massive deal for them. Maybe too big a deal.
It certainly is, yeah. Novo Nordisk's sales are primarily divided into two major geographic regions, North America Operations, or NAO, and International Operations, IO.
And NAO, that's basically the U.S. market.
Right. Exactly. Now. Primarily, yes. North America operations, predominantly the United States, is by far the company's largest and most critical market. In 2023, sales in NAO grew an astonishing 54% at constant exchange rates.
54% growth. Wow.
Incredible growth. And it was almost entirely driven by the immense, just insatiable demand for Ozempic and Wegovy. But you hinted at the risk. This heavy reliance on the U.S. market does represent a significant geographic concentration risk.
How so?
Well, it makes the company particularly vulnerable to U.S.-specific pricing pressures, regulatory changes, things that can be quite dynamic and, frankly, unpredictable over there. Think of it like having most of your eggs in one very valuable but potentially volatile basket.
That makes perfect sense. What about international operations, then? How do those markets compare?
The international operations segment includes Europe, the Middle East, and Africa, EMEA, as well as China and the rest of the world. Now, they also demonstrated strong performance, with 16% constant exchange rate growth in 2023, which is great.
Still strong, but not 54%.
Exactly. More modest compared to North America. And this difference reflects the varied pricing and reimbursement landscapes across those regions. Also, the different stages of market development for GLP-1 therapies. It's a broader, more diversified revenue base internationally, but not nearly as explosive as the U.S. market right now.
Yeah.
And each region presents its own unique challenges for market penetration.
Okay, so how does a company with this kind of phenomenal but concentrated growth maintain its position, especially with that reliance on semaglutide? What protects its business?
That's the billion-dollar question, isn't it? Novo Nordisk's business model is fortified by several powerful and, importantly, reinforcing competitive moats.
Yeah.
These aren't just isolated advantages. They work together, like layers of an ancient fortress, creating a formidable defense around their business.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting. Reinforcing layers of protection. So, tell us, what are these moats? Break them down for us.
Right. First, there's their scientific expertise and R&D leadership. A century of singular focus on protein-based therapies has created this deep well of institutional knowledge, particularly in metabolic diseases. This profound expertise underpins a robust R&D engine that has consistently produced innovative, market-leading products. They truly understand the intricate biology here better than almost anyone. That's a massive head start.
Okay, deep science. What's next?
Second, their intellectual property, IP. They boast a formidable patent portfolio. This includes what's often called a patent thicket.
A thicket, like dense woods.
Kind of, yeah. Imagine building a medieval castle.
Yeah.
You have the main towering walls, that's the main drug patent. But then you add multiple layers of outer walls, moats, hidden traps.
Yeah.
These are secondary patents on specific formulations, manufacturing processes, even the sophisticated delivery devices like their pens. This dense thicket protects their key products from generic competition well into the next decade. It acts as a complex legal barrier that's incredibly difficult for rivals to navigate.
Clever. Okay, science, IP, what else?
Third, and critically important right now, is manufacturing scale. The company's massive, vertically integrated manufacturing infrastructure for biologics represents a significant capital barrier to entry for any competitor. Producing these complex, protein-based drugs at the scale Novo Nordisk does requires immense investment and specialized know-how.
Yeah.
And they are actively widening this moat, pouring billions into ongoing investments, making it exceedingly difficult for new entrants to compete on sheer production capacity. It's like they're building an entire city infrastructure just for a few key products.
Manufacturing as a weapon. Got it. And the final layer.
And finally, brand equity and commercial infrastructure. Strong brand recognition for products like Ozempic and Wegovy isn't just about marketing spend. It's about decades of trust and consistent performance. This is coupled with long-standing relationships with endocrinologists, who are key prescribers, and a powerful global commercial footprint. All of this creates a durable market presence that is incredibly hard for newcomers to replicate.
So these layers really reinforce each other. Science, IP, manufacturing scale, brand, making them exceptionally resilient.
Exactly. Very difficult to dislodge.
Okay, building on those formidable moats, let's zoom out a bit to the broader industry. Novo Nordisk is riding this massive wave in two of the largest and fastest growing therapeutic markets. What are those markets and what makes them so dynamic right now?
You're absolutely right. Novo Nordisk operates right at the epicenter of the global diabetes and obesity treatment markets. And these markets are experiencing, well, unprecedented growth, driven by a confluence of factors, demographic trends, scientific breakthroughs, and shifting medical paradigms that are just redefining how we treat these chronic conditions.
Give us some numbers to really paint the picture. How big are we talking here?
Okay, the diabetes market is already massive. valued at approximately USD 88.3 billion in 2024. And it's forecast to expand at a compound annual growth rate, a CAGR, of 12.7%, projected to reach over USD 233 billion by 2032.
12.7% CAGR. That's pretty fast for pharma.
It is, significantly faster than many mature pharmaceutical markets. This robust growth is underpinned by the escalating global prevalence of the disease. Like you mentioned earlier, it's projected to affect 783 million adults by 2045, up from 537 million in 2021. And this surge is driven by factors we all recognize. Rising rates of obesity, increasingly sedentary lifestyles, aging populations worldwide. It's a global phenomenon.
Okay, huge diabetes market. What about obesity? That seems like the really explosive one.
It is. The obesity market is where we see truly hypergrowth, almost an explosion. This market, valued at about USD 15.9 billion in 2024, is projected to grow at an explosive CAGR of over 22%, reaching more than USD 60 billion by 2030.
22% plus.
And some industry forecasts are even more optimistic, projecting a potential market size of USD 150 billion by 2035.
150 billion for obesity treatments.
It sounds incredible, but it reflects the vast, untapped patient population. Millions, hundreds of millions of people who could benefit from treatment. And crucially, it reflects a paradigm shift. We're finally viewing obesity not merely as a lifestyle choice, but as a treatable chronic disease demanding effective medical interventions. And the GLP-1 therapies have been the absolute catalyst for this dramatic reevaluation and market expansion. They unlocked it.
Those numbers are just staggering. Makes perfect sense why this area is so attractive for investment and for competition. So speaking of competition, it must be fierce. Who are the key players? What does the landscape look like beyond Novo Nordisk?
Well, while Novo Nordisk has long been the established leader in diabetes care, the competitive landscape has been radically reshaped. We can now really describe it as a dynamic duopoly.
A duopoly, meaning just two main players.
Essentially, yes, dominating the high growth end. Novo Nordisk maintains a leading global value market share in the overall diabetes market, 33.8% at the end of 2023. And within the critical GLP-1 class, they've historically held a dominant position with a volume share around 63% in 2024.
Okay, so they're still the leader there, but who's the other half of this duopoly?
The primary competitive threat, and it's a formidable one, comes from Eli Lilly, LLY. Their dual GIP-GLP-1 agonist, tirzepatide, marketed as Mounjaro for diabetes and Zepbound for obesity, has demonstrated remarkable commercial success.
Right, Mounjaro and Zepbound, we hear those names a lot too.
And for good reason. In some head-to-head trials, tirzepatide has even shown superior weight loss efficacy compared to semaglutide. In fact, driven by the rapid uptake of its products, Eli Lilly reportedly surpassed Novo Nordisk in overall new-to-brand GLP-1 market share in the U.S. in early 2025, capturing something like 53%.
Wow. Okay, so Lilly is really challenging them directly.
Intensely. It defines the market now. An intense rivalry with both companies investing heavily billions in manufacturing, R&D, and commercial activities to gain an edge.
Are there other players trying to get in?
Well, other competitors like Sanofi remain significant in the legacy insulin market, but they currently lack a strong offering in this high-growth GLP-1 obesity space.
Mm-hmm.
There are also a host of other large pharmaceutical and biotech companies, Amgen, Viking Therapeutics, others developing next-generation obesity treatments. These could lead to maybe greater market fragmentation down the road, but for now, for the foreseeable future, it's very much about this duopoly. Novo versus Lilly.
So it's this two-horse race. But it sounds like both horses are winning right now because the market's growing so fast. That seems counterintuitive.
It does, but that's the crucial insight into the current dynamic. It's unique. Demand for GLP-1s far exceeds the combined supply of both Novo Nordisk and Eli Lilly.
Ah, the supply constraints again?
Exactly. This means the near-term environment is not a zero-sum game. Both companies are able to grow revenues at an exceptional rate simply by collectively expanding the market and bringing new patients onto therapy. So while it looks like a simple race to produce more drug,
Which it partly is, absolutely,
it actually allows both companies a luxury right now. They can experiment more with market positioning, maybe even choose which subsegments to prioritize for now, knowing demand will absorb pretty much any supply they can make.
But that luxury won't last forever.
It won't. As manufacturing capacity scales up over the next few years, and both are spending massively to make that happen, the competition will inevitably shift. It'll go from a race to produce to a head-to-head battle for market share based on product differentiation.
Differentiation like
efficacy, tolerability, convenience, think oral versus injectable, and ultimately price. So their future differentiation strategies are quietly being forged now, even amidst this current demand frenzy. It really raises an important question. In a market with such immense unmet need, can both giants thrive indefinitely? Or will it inevitably become more of a zero-sum game? The supply constraints mean it's a race to produce today, but that won't last forever.
That's a critical point. The dynamic is set to change. Beyond the direct competition, what about the broader regulatory environment and the patent landscape? How do those shape the playing field?
Well, the pharmaceutical industry, by its nature, operates under strict oversight. Regulatory bodies like the US FDA, the European Medicines Agency, EMA, they call the shots on approvals. For Novo Nordisk, a key strategic imperative is securing label expansions for existing drugs based on positive outcomes trials.
Outcomes trials, meaning they show benefits beyond just the main disease?
Exactly. A great example is the cardiovascular risk reduction indication they got for Wegovy after the SELECT trial. This significantly enhances a product's value proposition, not just to doctors, but crucially to payers, insurance companies, governments who look for broad benefits beyond the primary indication. It's about proving the drug doesn't just treat the disease, but genuinely improves overall patient health and ultimately saves money for the healthcare system in the long run. That's the gold standard.
Got it. And patents, you mentioned the thicket earlier. How critical is that?
The patent landscape is paramount. Absolutely critical. Novo Nordisk's key composition of matter patent for semaglutide, the core patent, is expected to expire in the U.S. and Europe around 2031, 2032.
The early 2030s. That's the patent cliff everyone talks about.
That's the one. It represents the single largest long-term risk to the company because it opens the door to generic competition, which usually means much lower prices and market share loss. So to mitigate this, Novo employs that highly sophisticated legal strategy of building the patent thicket we discussed. That dense web of secondary patents covering manufacturing processes, drug formulations, delivery devices, it's all designed to delay the entry of generic and biosimilar competitors for as long as possible after the main patent falls.
Buying time.
Exactly. It's a crucial defensive strategy to protect their golden goose for as long as legally possible, giving their pipeline time to deliver the next generation.
It really sounds like an incredibly tough industry to break into, even for innovative new companies. What are the main barriers keeping others out, protecting players like Novo Nordisk?
The barriers to entry in these innovative diabetes and obesity markets are exceptionally high. It naturally protects the incumbents like Novo and Lilly. First, there are prohibitive R&D costs. Just staggering. The cost of discovering, developing, and running global phase 3 outcomes trials for a new metabolic drug can easily run into the billions of dollars. Billions with a B.
Billions just for one drug's trials.
Easily. Right. And it's not just about initial discovery. It's about proving safety and efficacy on a massive scale, over long periods, across diverse patient populations. It's an immense financial gamble.
Okay. R&D cost. What else?
Second, complex manufacturing. We touched on this. The production of complex biologics like GLP-1s requires specialized expertise, sophisticated infrastructure, and massive capital investment in manufacturing facilities. This is a barrier that Novo Nordisk and Eli Lilly are actively raising right now through their multi-billion dollar capacity expansions, making it even harder for new players to catch up on production alone. You can't just outsource this cheaply or quickly.
Right, that manufacturing moat you mentioned. And the third barrier.
And third, the clinical data moat. Gaining regulatory approval and, critically, broad reimbursement from payers requires extensive clinical data, including those long-term cardiovascular outcomes trials we discussed. Generating this data takes years and significant investment. It creates a substantial time and cost advantage for established players who already have these approvals and data sets. New entrants simply can't skip these steps or rush through them. You have to put in the time and the capital to earn your place. It takes a long time to build that kind of evidence base.
So it's a formidable foundation, century of focus, golden molecule, hypergrowth market, but also intense competition and high barriers. Next, let's dig even deeper into how Novo leverages its specific advantages, its IP, manufacturing, R&D, to stay ahead. Okay, let's dig deeper into those competitive advantages you laid out. How does Novo Nordisk specifically leverage its IP, its manufacturing muscle, and its R&D engine to maintain leadership? Not just stay afloat, but lead.
Right. These are the core pillars of their strategic position.
Yeah.
And they leverage them very actively. First, let's revisit the IP fortress. Patent portfolio and pipeline protection. Intellectual property, as we said, is the lifeblood here. The core composition of matter patent for semaglutide provides market exclusivity in the U.S. until December 2031, similar timelines elsewhere. That's the foundation. But beyond this primary patent, they have constructed that formidable patent thicket.
Right, the extra layers of walls and traps.
Exactly. Numerous secondary patents. On specific formulations, like the oral delivery tech in Rybelsus, on methods of use for new indications as they discover them, and on the proprietary technology in their pen injector devices. This layered IP strategy is designed specifically to create legal hurdles, to significantly delay the launch of generic or biosimilar versions well beyond the expiration of that core patent. It extends their revenue runway for years.
It's a sophisticated legal defense planned years in advance. What about manufacturing? You called it a core strategic weapon. How does that play out as a competitive edge day to day?
It absolutely has become one. And this current supply-constrained GLP-1 market, manufacturing isn't just support anymore, it is strategy. Novo Nordisk's capabilities here represent a powerful competitive advantage that very few can match. As the world's largest producer of insulin and now GLP-1s, the company possesses deep institutional expertise. In the incredibly complex processes of fermentation, purification, sterile fill finish, doing it for biologic drugs at an immense scale.
Yeah, think about it. In a market exploding with demand, simply being able to make enough of your product is a superpower right now. That Catalent acquisition you mentioned, that wasn't just about growth, was it? It feels like it was about control.
Precisely. It was absolutely about control and securing capacity. Recognizing that production capacity is the primary bottleneck to growth right now, they've embarked on this unprecedented capital expenditure program, committing over DKK 129 billion in 2024 alone to expand its global manufacturing footprint.
129 billion Danish kroner. That's what, nearly 20 billion US dollars in 1 year?
Roughly, yes. It's massive. Includes expansions of existing sites in Denmark and the U.S., plus that strategic acquisition of 3 fill-finish facilities from Catalent for USD 11.7 billion. This aggressive investment in vertical integration isn't just about meeting overwhelming demand today. It serves to build that formidable manufacturing moat even higher, raising the capital and technical barriers for any competitor seeking to challenge its scale and reliability. It's about owning every step of that complex process to ensure supply.
That is a staggering investment. And it's clearly not just about today's demand. It's about securing their future. A huge part of that future hinges on what comes after semaglutide. So how are they feeding that innovation engine? Let's talk R&D. What's going on there?
Right. With that 100-year legacy of innovation, Novo Nordisk's R&D organization is another key pillar. The company has successfully navigated multiple technology cycles in diabetes care. From animal-derived insulins to human insulins, modern insulin analogs, and now this era of incretin-based therapies like GLP-1s, they've proven they can adapt and lead scientific advancements repeatedly.
So they have a track record of reinvention.
They do. And their current R&D approach is increasingly sophisticated, integrating cutting-edge technology platforms to enhance productivity. For example, they're leveraging artificial intelligence and machine learning, AML, to mine these vast data sets from their clinical trials. Like the SELECT-T study data.
Using AI on trial data, how does that help?
Imagine sifting through millions of patient data points from trials like SELECT, looking for subtle genetic markers or patient profiles that respond best to certain therapies, or even identifying entirely new disease pathways they hadn't considered before. AI helps them see patterns no human could easily spot. It accelerates discovery and makes R&D potentially far more targeted and efficient. Furthermore, they use strategic acquisitions and partnerships, like the purchase of Dicerna Pharmaceuticals, which brought in new tech capabilities like RNA interference or RNAi.
RNAi, that sounds different from their usual protein drugs.
It is. It opens up new avenues for treating diseases by targeting intracellular pathways, things that are inaccessible to traditional protein therapies. It broadens their toolkit. And their R&D pipeline really reflects this innovative capacity. They have next-generation multi-agonist therapies like CagriSema and amycretin aiming to once again raise the bar for efficacy in metabolic disease.
Okay, it's clear they're focused on the cutting-edge science, but how do they get these innovative products actually into the hands of patients? What about their brand recognition, relationships with doctors? That seems crucial, too.
Absolutely crucial. Decades of singular focus on diabetes allowed Novo Nordisk to build unparalleled brand equity. Deep, trusted relationships with the key prescribers in the field, endocrinologists, primary care physicians. This established commercial presence provides a significant advantage when launching new products. They already have the network and the credibility built over decades.
So they have the doctor's trust.
Yes. And moreover, this GLP-1 phenomenon has transcended traditional medical marketing. The brand names Ozempic and Wegovy have achieved a level of consumer awareness rarely seen in the prescription drug market. It's fueled by pervasive media coverage, social media buzz.
Yeah, you hear about them everywhere. Late night talk shows, celebrity news.
Exactly. How many prescription drugs can you name offhand that have become part of everyday conversations like that? This has created a powerful patient-driven pull effect. Patients actively requesting the drugs by name for their doctors.
Ah, the patient asking for the drug. That's powerful.
Very powerful. It mirrors their past success with the NovoPen, where focusing on patient needs for convenience created a whole new market dynamic. This powerful brand recognition pressures healthcare providers to prescribe and, importantly, pressures payers to provide reimbursement. It solidifies their commercial position from multiple angles.
That patient demand must be a huge driver. Lastly, on advantages, how well do they navigate the complex world of regulatory approvals? That can be a minefield for any pharma company.
They have a long and remarkably successful history navigating the complex global regulatory landscape. It's a core competency. Specifically, the company has demonstrated real expertise in designing and executing these large-scale, long-term cardiovascular outcomes trials, the CVOTs. The success of trials like LEADER for Victoza and SELECT for Wegovy is a critical differentiator.
Why are those trials so important?
Because they provide the high-quality evidence needed not just for initial approval, but for those valuable label expansions like cardiovascular risk reduction. This ability to prove that its medicines don't just treat the primary condition, but also save lives and reduce costly healthcare events like heart attacks or strokes, that's essential. It's how you justify premium pricing and secure broad market access from increasingly cost-conscious payers around the world. It speaks volumes about their scientific rigor and their regulatory savvy.
Okay, all these strategic advantages, market dynamics, it must translate into some pretty impressive financial numbers. Let's get to the bottom line now. How has Novo Nordisk actually been performing financially? What does that tell us about the health of the business?
Well, their financial performance over the past decade, particularly the last few years, has been characterized by a really dramatic inflection in growth and profitability. It's driven almost entirely by the commercial success of this GLP-1 franchise. The company exhibits truly best-in-class financial metrics, reflecting its dominant market position and the high value of its innovative products.
Give us some highlights. Revenue, earnings, margins, what do those numbers really signify?
If you look at their financial history, you see a period of steady, maybe single-digit to low double-digit growth. And then, boom, an explosive acceleration starting around 2021. Revenue growth surged from a modest 6.3% in 2020 to an incredible 34.6% in 2023.
34% growth for a company that size.
Huge. And continued strong growth of 24.9% reported for 2024. This top-line momentum has translated into exceptional profitability. The company consistently maintains gross profit margins above 84%.
84% gross margin, that's very high.
Extremely high. A testament to efficient manufacturing and strong pricing power. More impressively, significant operating leverage has driven their operating profit margin to over 44% and the net profit margin to over 36% in recent years.
44% operating margin.
It places Novo Nordisk among the most profitable companies in the entire pharmaceutical industry. These are truly world-class margins, indicating significant pricing power and that manufacturing efficiency we talked about. If you look at their 10-year financial summary data, you can clearly see this acceleration in growth rates, and sustain high margins. It signals a fundamental shift in their economic engine.
That's incredible performance. And we discussed the two main segments earlier, diabetes, obesity, and rare disease. How does that performance break down between them? What does that reveal?
Yeah, the breakdown by segment really underscores the company's increasing reliance on its diabetes and obesity care franchise. That segment delivered spectacular growth, 42% in 2023, 27% in the first half of 2024. And maintain consistently high operating margins, around 48%.
A 48% margin in that main segment.
Yeah, okay. That's where the overwhelming majority of their profit comes from. Now, in stark contrast, the rare disease segment has actually contracted. Sales declines of 15% in 2023, 3% in the first half of 2024, and it even reported a negative operating profit recently.
Negative profit in rare disease.
Yeah. So this highlights both the immense success of the GLP-1 business, but also that potential concentration risk we keep mentioning. If that GLP-1 momentum were to falter, the rare disease segment currently offers quite limited diversification benefits in its current state.
Right. So much writing on diabetes and obesity. With all this growth, how are their returns on capital looking? ROE, ROIC, what do those numbers tell us about how effectively they're using investor money?
Novo Nordisk has historically generated exceptionally high returns on capital. It's a hallmark of a company with a strong, sustainable competitive advantage. For the full year 2023, they reported a return on equity, ROE, of 83.8%.
83.8%.
Yeah. And a return on invested capital, ROIC, of 66.3%.
Those numbers sound astronomical. What's typical for the industry?
Well, for most mature industries, maybe anything over 15-20% ROIC is considered exceptional. Novo Nordisk isn't just exceptional, they're in a completely different league. It signals incredibly efficient use of capital and a powerful competitive moat, allowing them to turn every dollar invested into a staggering amount of profit historically.
But you said historically, is there a catch?
There is a bit of context needed. These stellar historical metrics must be viewed with some caution now. What's fascinating here is that these are generated on a capital base established before the current period of massive reinvestment. The company is now in what you could call a CapEx supercycle, deploying tens of billions of dollars into new manufacturing facilities.
Ah, that factory building we discussed.
Exactly. This will dramatically increase the invested capital and equity denominators used in these calculations. The base is getting much bigger. So while profits are also growing, it is mathematically very difficult to maintain such stratospheric return rates on a much larger and rapidly expanding capital base.
So the percentages might come down, even if the actual dollar profits keep rising.
Precisely. Investors should therefore anticipate a gradual normalization of these metrics from their current peak levels down to what would still be considered excellent, absolutely best in class for the industry, but perhaps more sustainable levels long term.
That makes perfect sense. Investing heavily for future growth will naturally impact the rate of return, even if absolute returns remain strong. How does this translate into their cash flow and balance sheet? Are they swimming in cash?
The business model is highly cash generative. Cash flow from operating activities has grown robustly, reaching DKK 108.9 billion in 2023. This strong operating cash flow comfortably funds their significant R&D efforts, their massive capital expenditures, and their returns to shareholders like dividends. Free cash flow stood at a very healthy DKK 68.3 billion in 2023.
So lots of cash coming in. How's the balance sheet holding up with all the spending?
Their balance sheet is also strong, provides ample capacity for further investment. As of year-end 2023, total assets were DKK 314.5 billion against total equity of DKK 106.6 billion, resulting in a solid equity ratio of about 33.9%. Now, debt levels have increased a bit, mainly to help fund that significant CapEx program and strategic acquisitions like Catalent. But the company's leverage ratios remain conservative and well within manageable limits. This financial strength allows them to be aggressive in pursuing growth opportunities without overextending themselves.
Okay, solid financials, massive cash flow. Speaking of growth opportunities, what does the future look like? What are the key drivers that will sustain this trajectory beyond just the current GLP-1 wave? Where does the next wave of growth come from?
Right. Novo Nordisk is positioned at the forefront of this major secular growth trend in healthcare, managing chronic metabolic disease. Their future growth trajectory will really be determined by their ability to capitalize on, well, several things: continued expansion of the GLP-1 market itself, successfully executing on their deep R&D pipeline to bring next-generation therapies to market, and penetrating new geographic markets globally.
Let's start with the GLP-1 market opportunity itself. How much more room is there really for growth, given how much has already happened? Seems like everyone's already heard of these drugs.
You'd think so, but the primary growth driver is still the continued global adoption of GLP-1s. And the opportunity extends across several dimensions. For one, just obesity market penetration. The global obesity market remains largely untapped, with over 800 million people worldwide living with obesity, and only a tiny fraction currently receiving any medical treatment for it. The runway for growth for highly effective therapies like Wegovy is immense.
800 million people globally.
Globally. We're talking about a vast ocean of unmet medical need. We barely scratched the surface.
Okay, huge potential just getting treatment to more people with obesity. What else?
Beyond that, there's expansion into new indications. The therapeutic potential of GLP-1s extends beyond just diabetes and weight loss. Positive clinical trial data is emerging, or already here, for treating related comorbidities. Things like metabolic dysfunction-associated steatohepatitis, essentially fatty liver disease, cardiovascular disease, as we saw with select chronic kidney disease.
So using the same drug for other related problems.
Exactly. Each successful label expansion would significantly increase the total addressable market and further entrench semaglutide, or its successors, as a foundational therapy in cardiometabolic medicine. There is even early-stage research exploring its potential in neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's.
Alzheimer's.
Really?
Early days.
Very early. But it shows the potential breadth. This kind of expansion adds significant long-term value, potentially transforming it into a true platform drug used across multiple conditions.
That pipeline sounds incredibly important then, especially with that patent cliff looming, what, 7-8 years down the line for semaglutide. What's in the next generation? How are they preparing for that future after Ozempic and Wegovy?
Absolute critical. The company's long-term value is heavily dependent on that R&D pipeline. It's designed to extend their leadership in metabolic diseases and defend their franchise against competitors and that eventual patent expiration. But the pipeline strategy is largely focused on what they call mechanism stacking.
Mechanism stacking.
That's complex. It is. Combining the GLP-1 mechanism with other biological pathways like amylin, which we'll mention, to achieve even greater efficacy or broader benefits. Now, this approach holds the promise of creating next-generation, potentially best-in-class therapies. But it also introduces a higher degree of clinical and biological risk compared to single agonist drugs. It's a more complex challenge, but the potential rewards are bigger.
So higher risk, higher reward. What are some key assets in this pipeline?
Okay, key pipeline assets to watch. First, CagriSema. This combines semaglutide with cagrilintide, which is an amylin analog. Phase 3 data showed really impressive weight loss, 22.7%. positioning it as a direct competitor to Lilly's tirzepatide, or Zepbound.
Okay, CagriSema. What else?
Then there's amycretin. This one has generated a lot of excitement recently. It's a highly promising next-generation candidate. It's a unimolecular co-agonist, meaning one molecule hitting both the GLP-1 and amylin receptors. Early data has been exceptional, showing 13.1% weight loss with an oral version at just 12 weeks, and 22.0% with a subcutaneous injectable version at 36 weeks. That really signals a potential leap forward.
Amycretin, oral and injectable, that sounds very promising. Anything else major?
They're also developing a higher-dose oral semaglutide, a 50-milligram version in phase 3, aiming for weight loss efficacy comparable to injectable Wegovy. That would be huge for patient convenience, obviously. Beyond the core metabolic focus, they have insulin icodec, the first once-weekly basal insulin, which is already filed for approval, could simplify insulin regimens significantly. And ziltivekimab, an IL-6 inhibitor they acquired, targeting cardiovascular disease directly. Plus MIM-8 in their rare disease segment, a bispecific antibody for hemophilia A. So the pipeline shows a clear commitment to diversifying and advancing their therapeutic offerings well into the future, trying to build the next wave.
Okay, developing new drugs, new formulations. What about expanding geographically? Are there big markets left to conquer beyond the already strong U.S. and the growing European presence?
Yes, definitely. While North America is the current growth engine, significant long-term opportunities lie in international markets, particularly emerging economies. The launch of Wegovy in key European markets like the UK and Germany has already been met with strong demand, though, again, constrained by supply issues. Securing broader reimbursement across the continent is a key priority and a major opportunity there.
And outside Europe?
And then there's China, with an estimated 184 million people living with obesity.
184 million.
Wow. It represents a massive potential market. The regulatory decision for Wegovy is expected in 2024. That could unlock a major new avenue for growth. However, conquering the Chinese market comes with its own set of complexities. A unique regulatory environment, adapting pricing to a different healthcare infrastructure, intense local competition, successfully navigating those hurdles will be key. And more broadly, as economies develop and healthcare spending increases, the prevalence of diabetes and obesity is rising rapidly in many low and middle income countries too, creating long-term growth potential there as well.
It sounds like they're looking at growth from all angles. New drugs, new markets. Are they also exploring things like digital health, integrating technology? Is that part of the plan?
It seems to be, yeah. There's a growing opportunity for Novo Nordisk to create a more comprehensive ecosystem of care around its therapies. Moving beyond just the pill or the injection itself, this could involve partnerships or maybe in-house development of digital health tools, mobile apps, connect devices, wearable sensors, things to help patients manage their condition, improve adherence, track outcomes. Such an ecosystem could potentially increase patient loyalty significantly and provide valuable real-world data to further refine treatment strategies, extending their impact beyond just the drug itself into a more complete patient support system.
Okay, we've covered the incredible opportunities, the strengths, the strategic advantages, the vast market. It's an impressive picture. But every company, no matter how successful, faces headwinds. Let's shift gears now. What are the key risks and challenges for Novo Nordisk that listeners should really be aware of?
Right. Despite its formidable market position and exceptional growth, Novo Nordisk faces a range of significant risks that could definitely impact its long-term value. These challenges span competitive, regulatory, operational, and clinical domains. It's important to remember, like you said, even the most successful stories come with caveats and inherent challenges.
Let's start with the big one you mentioned earlier, the patent cliff. You called it the single greatest long-term risk. How severe is that threat, really? What are the implications?
It is indeed the big one looming. The company's profound dependence on the semaglutide franchise, Ozempic, Wegovy, Rybelsus, makes it so. With those core patents set to expire in the early 2030s, Novo Nordisk faces a monumental patent cliff. The failure of its R&D pipeline to deliver one or more new blockbuster products to offset the eventual erosion of semaglutide sales, well, that would have severe consequences for revenue and profitability. This high degree of product concentration makes the company's valuation highly sensitive to the long-term outlook for the GLP-1 market and, crucially, its ability to innovate beyond semaglutide. It really raises an important question. Can even the most robust patent thicket truly withstand the inevitable tide of generic competition once the core patents fall? Or is it more about delaying the inevitable and buying critical time for the next innovation wave to arrive?
That's a critical question indeed. And speaking of competition, Eli Lilly seems like a very real, very strong rival, gaining ground rapidly. What's the dark side of the duopoly here, the direct competitive threat?
The primary competitive threat is immediate and intense. Eli Lilly's dual agonist tirzepatide Mounjaro in Zepbound has already proven to be a formidable challenger, rapidly gaining market share and, as we noted, demonstrating potentially superior efficacy in some clinical comparisons. The long-term battle for market leadership will be fought on the grounds of next-generation product superiority. So a key risk for Novo is that a competitor, whether it's Lilly with its own advanced pipeline, or maybe another player like Amgen, develops a therapy with a demonstrably better profile.
Better in what way? Just more weight loss?
Not necessarily just weight loss. It could be efficacy, yes, but also safety, tolerability, or convenience. For instance, while the market currently seems focused on achieving the absolute highest percentage of weight loss, imagine a competitor's product that's maybe good enough on efficacy, but offers clearly superior tolerability, fewer side effects, or the massive convenience of an effective daily oral pill. That could capture significant market share from a more potent, but perhaps less user-friendly injectable.
So it's a constant battle for differentiation, and the advantage could shift based on factors other than just raw power.
Exactly. The goalposts might move.
Okay. Competition is fierce. What about manufacturing? The demand is so high, they face shortages. What are the risks associated with scaling up production so dramatically? Can they actually meet this overwhelming demand?
The unprecedented demand for its GLP-1 products has placed just immense strain on Novo Nordisk's manufacturing and supply chain. A situation the company itself acknowledges has led to periodic constraints and drug shortages, frustrating for patients and doctors. To address this, they've embarked on that massive global expansion of production capacity, committing those huge sums over DKK 129 billion in 2024 CapEx, expected DKK 65 billion in 2025.
The numbers are huge, but what's the risk in doing that?
The strategy, while absolutely necessary, is fraught with execution risk. Large-scale biopharmaceutical manufacturing projects are notoriously complex, they're capital-intensive, and they're prone to delays, quality control issues, cost overruns. Any significant setback in bringing this new capacity online in a timely and compliant manner would directly cap the company's revenue growth potential.
Because they can't sell what they can't make.
Exactly. And every delay means potentially lost sales to competitors like Lilly, who can produce and meet the demand. It's a high-stakes race to build and operate flawlessly.
What about external pressures, like government regulations, pricing controls? Are those potential long-term headwinds for profitability?
Yes, definitely. As a global pharmaceutical leader, Novo Nordisk is subject to stringent regulatory oversight and, increasingly, pricing pressure from governments and private payers worldwide. In the U.S., its largest market, the Inflation Reduction Act, or IRA, introduces the prospect of government price negotiation for drugs covered by Medicare.
Price negotiation, meaning the government can force lower prices?
Potentially, yes, for certain high-spend drugs, after they've been on the market for a number of years. This could erode long-term profitability for key products like Ozempic if it gets selected down the line. Furthermore, securing and maintaining broad, unrestricted reimbursement for obesity treatments specifically remains a challenge.
Why is obesity coverage still a challenge?
Some payers, particularly in the U.S., are still hesitant to cover what they may perceive as lifestyle drugs, despite the growing mountain of evidence showing profound health benefits and long-term cost savings. This perception, however outdated, can lead to limits on coverage, high copays, prior authorizations, hurdles for patient access.
Got it. Okay, another major risk factor, the pipeline. Their future valuation seems heavily reliant on those new drugs like Cagrilintide and amycretin succeeding. What happens if they don't pan out?
That's a huge risk. The company's strategy for growth beyond semaglutide is almost entirely dependent on the success of that R&D pipeline. The current high valuation of the company's stock reflects significant optimism, frankly, baked in assumptions about late-stage assets like Cagrilintide and early-stage programs like amycretin. A failure of any of these key programs in pivotal clinical trials may be due to insufficient efficacy compared to competitors, or an unfavorable safety profile emerging, or other issues would severely undermine that long-term growth narrative, and it could lead to a significant re-rating of the stock downwards. The market has priced in a lot of future success from these assets, so any major stumble could have a really cascading negative effect.
High expectations mean high risk if they're not met. Finally, what about some of the less obvious risks? Things like currency fluctuations or even just administrative mistakes.
Good point. With operations in 80 countries and sales in 170, the company has significant exposure to foreign currency fluctuations. Swings in exchange rates can impact reported financial results, adding volatility to their earnings, even if the underlying business is strong. And yes, administrative risks are real, even for giant companies. A recent, almost unbelievable event highlights this perfectly. The lapse of a key semaglutide patent in Canada.
Canada, what happened?
It lapsed due to an administrative failure. They apparently failed to pay a small maintenance fee, something like $450.
Okay, let's unpack this. A company worth hundreds of billions of dollars and a tiny administrative oversight forgetting to pay a $450 fee leads to a patent lapse in a major market.
It seems incredible, but it happened. Yeah. It just shows that even the biggest, most sophisticated players aren't immune to human error or process failures.
Wow. And such small details can have potentially significant financial consequences down the line. It's a powerful reminder that operational excellence isn't just about building massive factories. It's about flawless execution at every single level, even the seemingly tiny ones.
Absolutely. A stark reminder indeed.
That Canadian patent lapse is definitely a stark reminder. Okay, let's turn now to how Novo Nordisk plans to steer this massive enterprise into the future, navigating all these opportunities and risks. How do they allocate their capital, especially with all these growth demands and the need to invest so heavily? What are their priorities?
Their capital allocation strategy is really deeply influenced by the long-term perspective of their controlling shareholder, the Novo Nordisk Foundation. They think in decades, not quarters. Their priorities are quite clear and hierarchical. First, invest in internal growth opportunities. That means funding their R&D pipeline, and crucially right now, those massive capital expenditures for manufacturing.
Reinvestment first. Makes sense.
After that, they prioritize paying an attractive growing annual dividend to shareholders. Then, pursuing value-accretive business development like M&A, if the right opportunities arise. And finally, distributing any truly excess cash to shareholders via share buybacks.
So buybacks are last on the list?
Typically, yes. Historically, this resulted in a balanced approach. However, the explosive demand for GLP-1s has triggered a pretty dramatic strategic shift in emphasis recently. Investment in CapEx, in building factories, has become the overwhelming top priority. Planned expenditures have quadrupled since 2021 to support this massive scale-up of production capacity. As we said, CapEx reached DKK 47.2 billion in 2024, and it's expected to rise to around DKK 65 billion in 2025. This truly reflects the critical need to build out their global supply chain just to meet this unprecedented demand. It's an all-hands-on-deck approach to manufacturing right now.
So reinvestment is absolutely king right now, building capacity above all else. What about dividends for shareholders amidst all this spending? And their M&A strategy has that shifted too.
Well, Novo Nordisk has a strong and very consistent track record of returning capital to shareholders through dividends. They aim for a stable dividend payout ratio and have consistently grown their dividend per share over many years. They propose DKK 9.40 per share for 2023. Given the company's robust earnings growth and strong cash flow generation, the dividend appears highly sustainable. It's likely to continue growing, even with these elevated levels of reinvestment in CapEx. They seem committed to both.
Okay, so dividends remain solid. What about M&A? Are they buying other companies?
Their M&A strategy has traditionally focused on smaller, bolt-on acquisitions. designed to augment their internal R&D capabilities or gain access to novel technology platforms. Like that Dicerna Pharmaceuticals deal for RNAi technology we mentioned, they've generally avoided large transformative mergers in the past, not their style. However, a notable recent development was that acquisition of three fill-finish manufacturing sites from Catalent for $11.7 billion, executed via Novo Holdings, their parent.
Right, the Catalent deal. That felt different.
It was different. It represents a significant strategic pivot, I think. Rather than acquiring R&D assets, this deal is a form of vertical integration, aimed squarely at securing and accelerating the expansion of its manufacturing capacity. It signals a recognition that in the current supply-constrained market, control over the supply chain is a critical competitive advantage. And the company is willing to deploy significant capital to secure it, even buying manufacturing capacity directly.
That sounds like a management team with a very clear long-term vision, perhaps insulated from some of the short-term market pressures other companies face. How does their unique corporate governance, particularly the powerful role of the Novo Nordisk Foundation, play into this long-term thinking?
The quality of leadership and the integrity of governance are critical, absolutely.
Yeah.
Novo Nordisk is characterized by an experienced management team. Under CEO Lars Fruergaard Jørgensen, who took over in 2017, the company experienced this period of historic transformation and growth, propelling it to become the most valuable company in Europe for a time. Remarkable run.
But wasn't there news about him stepping down?
Yes, exactly. In May 2025, it was announced that Jørgensen would be stepping down. This decision, reportedly coming after a period of share price decline, was said to be influenced by the Novo Nordisk Foundation seeking a more active role in the company's strategic direction. This leadership transition, even amidst huge commercial success, introduces a degree of uncertainty, and it signals a potential strategic recalibration as the company confronts intensifying competition and prepares for its long-term future.
So the foundation is flexing its muscles a bit more.
It appears so. And what's fascinating here is how this unique ownership structure, far from being just a footnote, deeply influences the company's long-term strategy. It prioritizes sustained growth over, say, immediate financial engineering or short-term shareholder demands. The Novo Nordisk Foundation, through its holding company, Novo Holdings, controls an astounding 77.28% of the voting rights in Novo Nordisk.
77% control, wow.
Yeah. And the foundation has this dual mandate: provide a stable basis for the commercial activities of the Novo Group companies and support scientific and humanitarian causes with the profits. This controlling ownership provides a significant strategic advantage. It insulates the company from the pressures of short-term market fluctuations, activist investors. It enables management to make bold, long-term investments, like the current multi-billion-dollar manufacturing expansion, without constant quarterly scrutiny. The foundation's increased involvement, exemplified by the return of its chairman, Lars Rubian Sørensen, a former Novo CEO himself, to the company's board meetings as an observer, underscores its ultimate authority in setting the long-term strategic agenda.
So the foundation is the ultimate backstop and strategic guide. How does management stay aligned? Is there much insider ownership?
Interestingly, insider ownership among the executive team is relatively low. CEO Jørgensen owned about 0.015% of shares. So alignment with shareholders is primarily achieved through performance-based incentive programs tied to the company's long-term goals, like their strategic aspirations 2025.
Okay, so the foundation acts as this powerful long-term anchor. All of this culminates in the stock's valuation. What is the market saying about Novo Nordisk's price tag? Is it expensive? Cheap? How does it compare to peers?
Right, assessing the valuation.
Yeah.
It requires balancing this extraordinary growth profile and best-in-class profitability against the, frankly, high expectations embedded in its stock price. And those significant long-term risks we discussed, like the patent cliff. The company definitely trades at a premium, both to its own historical averages and to the broader pharmaceutical sector. A valuation that seems contingent on near flawless execution in the coming years.
What kind of multiples are we talking about?
Well, the stock's trailing price to earnings, or PE, ratio is currently in the range of maybe 19-21x, with a forward PE looking ahead of approximately 15-17x. This is notably higher than their historical norms before the big GLP-1 surge. Similarly, the enterprise value to EBITDA multiple, EBITDA, is in the 13-15x range. This premium valuation clearly indicates that the market has already priced in a substantial amount of future growth. If we connect this to the bigger picture, it implies the market is building in a lot of optimism about the future.
How does that compare to its closest rival, Eli Lilly? You hear them mentioned constantly in the same breath. Is Novo cheaper or more expensive than Lilly?
That's a great comparison, and it's revealing. Compared to its chief rival, Eli Lilly, Novo Nordisk's valuation actually appears more modest. Eli Lilly commands a much higher P.E. ratio, maybe around 43x, and an EV/EBITDA multiple around 36x.
Wow, much higher multiples for Lilly. What does that suggest?
It suggests the market may be pricing in even more aggressive growth, or perhaps perceives a higher probability of success for Lilly's pipeline, maybe due to tirzepatide's data or their own next-gen assets. Novo Nordisk trades at a significant premium to more mature pharmaceutical companies like Sanofi, which seems justified by its vastly superior growth rate. But the difference with Lilly is notable. It shows the market's differential assessment of their respective growth trajectories and pipeline strengths right now.
Okay. If you were to try and value Novo Nordisk using something like a discounted cash flow model, a DCF, what would be the really sensitive assumptions? What drives the valuation?
A DCF for Novo would be highly sensitive to a few key assumptions. First, revenue growth. You'd likely model high double-digit growth, maybe 20% plus, for the next 3 to 5 years, followed by a gradual deceleration as the market matures and competition intensifies. Second, the terminal growth rate assumption becomes critical, especially considering that patent play around 2031, 2032. How much growth can they realistically sustain after semaglutide potentially faces generic competition? That's a huge question mark. Third, profitability. You'd likely model operating margins at or near the current high levels, assuming they maintain pricing power and efficiency. And fourth, capital expenditures. This would be a significant deviation from historical norms. You'd have to model CapEx as a much higher percentage of sales in the near term to reflect this massive ongoing manufacturing expansion. It's a complex puzzle with many moving parts.
So what does this all mean for you, the listener? It sounds like the market is betting big on Novo Nordisk, but that means they absolutely have to deliver almost flawlessly on a massive scale.
Exactly. That sums it up well. The current valuation appears to be pricing in a scenario of near-perfect execution. It assumes Novo Nordisk will successfully scale manufacturing to meet the vast majority of near-term demand. It assumes its pipeline will deliver a successful successor, or successors, to semaglutide, allowing the company to defend its market share against Lilly and navigate that patent cliff without a catastrophic drop in revenue. It's a lot of assumptions.
What would a bull case look like, where things go even better than expected?
Well, in a bull case, the market for obesity drugs proves to be even larger than current optimistic forecasts. Maybe CagriSema and or amycretin demonstrate clear superiority over competing products, solidifying Novo's leadership for another decade. And successful label expansions into MASH, kidney disease, maybe even Alzheimer's, add further layers of significant growth.
And the bear case, where things could go wrong.
In a bear case, manufacturing scale-up hits significant snags, maybe quality issues or delays, ceding near-term market share to Lilly. The pipeline falters. CagriSema fails to show a compelling advantage over Zepbound, or maybe amycretin encounters unexpected safety or efficacy issues in later-stage trials. Or perhaps aggressive government price controls are implemented in the U.S. or elsewhere, severely compressing margins. In that kind of scenario, the current valuation would likely be unsustainable.
So the high valuation leaves little room for error.
Very little margin for error. Any significant stumble on the operational front, the clinical front, or the competitive front could lead to a substantial derating of the stock, as those high growth assumptions underpinning premium multiple would be seriously called into question.
Okay. So for listeners who want to keep a close eye on Novo Nordisk, maybe track how this incredibly dynamic story unfolds, what key metrics should they be monitoring? What are the signals to watch?
Right. To effectively track the investment thesis, you should closely monitor a specific set of leading indicators and upcoming catalysts. First, keep a sharp eye on market share trends in their core therapeutic areas. Look for the weekly and monthly prescription data, things like new to brand, NBRX, and total prescriptions, TRX, for Wegovy versus Zepbound, and Ozempic versus Mounjaro, particularly in the crucial U.S. market. This is the most direct, high-frequency indicator of that competitive dynamic with Eli Lilly, who's gaining, who's losing, week by week.
Okay, prescription trends. What's next?
Second, watch pipeline progression and regulatory milestones. Very important. Look for top-line data readouts from pivotal Phase 3 trials for CagriSema, key Phase 2 data for amycretin as it advances. Also, regulatory submission and approval dates for higher-dose oral semaglutide, insulin Icodec, and potential label expansions for Wegovy based on outcomes data, like for MESH or kidney disease. The company's long-term value is so contingent on this pipeline, so positive trial results are key validation points, and failures are major red flags.
Pipeline news. Got it. Third.
Third, monitor pricing trends and reimbursement changes. Market access is critical. This means updates on formulary status, which drugs get covered, and how easily and tiering for Wegovy and Ozempic with major U.S. pharmacy benefit managers, PBMs. Also, announcements of reimbursement decisions in key international markets, the UK's IC, Germany's GBA, China's NRDL process, and of course, any developments related to the U.S. Inflation Reduction Act price negotiations. Market access determines how many patients can actually get the drugs affordably.
Pricing and access. Makes sense. Fourth.
Fourth, keep tabs on manufacturing capacity utilization and expansion. Where are they with building those factories? Look for company guidance on supply constraints. Are they easing up or getting worse? Updates on the operational status of new manufacturing facilities, including those newly acquired Catalent sites, and their forward-looking capital expenditure forecasts. In the current supply-constrained environment, production capacity is a primary driver of revenue. Can they make enough?
Manufacturing updates.
Fifth, follow their geographic expansion progress. How are they doing outside the U.S.? Track reported sales growth in international operations. With a specific focus on performance in newly launched markets for Wegovy in Europe and the ramp-up in China, assuming it gets approved there soon, international markets represent the next major frontier for growth beyond the initial surge.
International growth.
And finally,
maybe a bit more forward-looking, consider R&D productivity metrics. Specifically, something like the number of new molecular entities, new drug candidates, entering phase one clinical trials each year. This serves as a leading indicator of the health and productivity of their early stage R&D engine, which is vital for ensuring a sustainable pipeline beyond the current late stage assets we've discussed. Are they refilling the pipeline for the 2030s and beyond? Okay, that's a great checklist. Prescriptions, pipeline, pricing, production, places, and productivity. Lots to watch. And there you have it, a truly deep dive into Novo Nordisk. We've journeyed from its foundational business model and its blockbuster drugs through the hyper-growth markets it dominates, examining its formidable competitive moats and the, well, unprecedented financial performance that has captured the world's attention.
We have. And we've also critically assessed the significant risks, that looming patent cliff, the intensifying rivalry with Eli Lilly, the enormous challenge of scaling manufacturing. It's a testament to the company's strength, absolutely, but also a reminder that even the most successful stories come with caveats and inherent challenges. The future looks bright, potentially, but it's certainly not without hurdles.
So after unpacking all of this, what stands out to you? Is Novo Nordisk, this unstoppable force, truly poised to redefine chronic disease management globally? Or does its reliance on essentially one core molecule and that intense competition make it a more precarious play in the long run than it might seem?
That's the multi-billion dollar question, isn't it? But maybe consider this as a final thought. If the future of health is increasingly about preventing and managing chronic conditions like obesity proactively, rather than just treating symptoms after the fact. What does a company like Novo Nordisk's incredible success tell us about the broader shift in healthcare priorities, and maybe what medical innovation itself will look like in the decades to come? Are we really witnessing the dawn of a new era of proactive health management driven by breakthroughs like these? Something to think about.
Definitely something to think about. That's all for this deep dive. We hope this has given you a powerful shortcut to being well-informed on Novo Nordisk. Join us next time for another deep dive into the topics that matter most to you.